when I was a kid, they were doing a remake of Miracle on 34th Street. And at that point, it had only been the movie with Natalie Wood, which I adored. And I loved her. And so when that movie came around, a remake for television, I auditioned and I didn't get it. And I was really disappointed. And my father was still alive at that time. And he sat me down and he said, don't worry about it. It just means something better is going to come along. And within 3 months, I was cast in Little House on the Prairie. So he was right.
On this episode of Shelf Life, the actor Melissa Gilbert talks about her life-changing decision to move to the Catskills and nominates two novels that are among her very favorites. One is an exemplar of hard-boiled detective fiction. The other is a saga that centers the lives of women traveling from 19th century Nova Scotia to ragtime New York and beyond.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. Signs point toward escalation as the war in Iran enters its third week. Thousands more U.S. forces are heading to the Middle East, including 2,200 Marines. And Iran's remaining missiles and drones are striking throughout the region, much aimed successfully at disrupting the world's oil supply. Prices are up 40% since the war, but Energy Secretary Chris Wright tells ABC News this week he foresees it coming to an end soon.
The conflict will come to the end in the next few weeks, and we'll see a rebound in supplies and a pushing down of prices after that.
Experts say a quick recovery is not possible. Meantime, the death toll from the war is growing. Some 2,000 Iranians and Lebanese have been killed. Millions have been displaced. And at least 13 U.S. service members have been killed. The Iraqi government is raising concerns about the risk of thousands of ISIS detainees escaping. They were transferred to Iraq from Syria last month by U.S. forces. Officials say there were six attacks Saturday on the Baghdad airport compound where the prisoners are now being held. NPR's Jane Arraf reports.
The U.S. military transported more than 5,000 accused ISIS fighters from northeastern Syria to Baghdad in March. That's when Syrian Kurdish forces were in danger of losing control of the prisons after Syrian government forces advanced and took over Kurdish-held territory. Iran and Iran-backed militias in Iraq have been attacking the airport in retaliation for U.S. attacks on Iran and its proxies. Iraq's Justice Ministry says some of the strikes Saturday landed very close to the prison, and it's concerned about the security of the facility. Jane Arraf, NPR News, in the Kurdistan region of Iraq.
As the war with Iran goes on, prediction market bets on battle moves are also heating up. This is raising questions about insider trading in Washington. At least one senator is sounding the alarm, saying Congress cannot police itself. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
Financial disclosure rules are clear. Lawmakers and staff must report stock, bond, and cryptocurrency earnings. But there are no specific rules for event contracts on prediction markets, says Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat.
Nobody has said to me we're making these bets, but I'm confident that they are.
Billions are wagered each week on prediction markets like Polymarket, where bets range from sports, elections, to war. But the rules governing how U.S. officials can use these new markets haven't kept up, says former White House ethics lawyer Richard Painter.
The problem is they may not have to disclose what they actually bet on, whether it was a football game or a war.
Bets on prediction markets include U.S. troop movements and Iranian regime change. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
It's NPR News. Voters in France are choosing mayors in 36,000 cities, towns, and hamlets in today's first round of municipal voting. The local races are being closely watched for signs of a national and international phenomenon. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the far right has been surging throughout much of France.
Marine Le Pen's working-class far-right National Rally Party hopes to capture three major cities in the south, Marseille and Nice and Toulon, and several smaller towns in between. The far left is looking to capture a swath of towns across the north. The French electorate is fragmented with the largest blocs on the extremes, and for the first time in 25 years, political commentators believe socialists governed Paris could swing right. But political analyst Jean-Yves Camus believes Parisians will stick with a center-left green coalition in the end.
Paris is an affluent city, well-educated people, well-off people who do not want any kind of extremism to take hold of the city council.
The second round runoff will take place on March 22nd. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
In the U.S., it's Selection Sunday, otherwise known as the start of March Madness, featuring the best in Division I college basketball. The 68 teams selected for the men's bracket will be revealed at 6 p.m. Eastern, followed by the women's teams 2 hours later. Tournament play gets underway this week for the next 3 weeks. It's single elimination until the championship. For women, that's April 5th in Phoenix, and men are the next day in Indianapolis. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Strawberry.me, whose career coaches offer professional support to help people get unstuck, gain clarity, and move forward, whether advancing in a current role or choosing a new direction altogether. More at Strawberry.me/public.
When I was a kid, they were doing a remake of Miracle on 34th Street. And at that point, it had only been the movie with Natalie Wood, which I adored, and I loved her. And so when that movie came around, a remake for television, I auditioned, and I didn't get it. And I was really disappointed. And my father was still alive at that time. And he sat me down and he said, "Don't worry about it. It just means something better is going to come along." And within 3 months, I was cast in Little House on the Prairie. So he was right.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Two very different novels take center stage in the reading life of the actor Melissa Gilbert. My guest in this episode of Shelf Life. One is Robert Crace's L.A. Requiem, a supercharged, propulsive slice of California noir, and the other is Fall on Your Knees by Anne Marie MacDonald, a multi-generational saga that stretches from Nova Scotia to the battlefields of the First World War and beyond. Gilbert knows something about writing herself, having published a memoir, Prairie Tale, in 2009, and a children's book, Daisy and Josephine, in 2014, as well as a cookbook. But she is best known for playing Laura Ingalls Wilder in the wildly successful TV series Little House on the Prairie, which ran for 9 years and 9 seasons. A quintessential bit of myth-making of the American West, it gained new fans during the pandemic, thanks in part to its values of self-reliance and fortitude in the face of adversity. Now Melissa has published a new memoir, Back to the Prairie, a funny, charming, and very inspiring account of leaving behind her Hollywood life for a dilapidated cottage in the Catskills, where she and her husband, the actor Timothy Busfield, found sanctuary during COVID and discovered an abiding love for nature, the garden, and the taste of a homegrown tomato. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So I have to ask, I know that Dr. Fauci was taken away by an owl, but how are the Andrews sisters doing?
The Andrews sisters are doing very well, as is their sister Peep. They're very chunky, fluffy, gleeful hens who eat a very clean, organic, whole diet and produce the most extraordinary eggs I've ever tasted in my life.
You had promised to bring me some, but
I forgot I walked out the door without the eggs. We have a separate little fridge just for eggs. And as I was getting ready to come here, I said to Tim, I have to take the eggs with me. And he said, don't forget. And I said, I won't. And I walked right out the door without the eggs.
Well, the names of your chickens, the Andrews sisters and the late lamented Dr. Fauci among them, are a clue, I think, to your wonderful sense of humor. I know at the end of your first memoir, Prairie Tale, you included a list of all the alternative titles you came up with for the book. One of them was, Does This Gingham Dress Make My Butt Look Fat? I wonder if you went through a similar exercise with your new book, Back to the Prairie.
We tossed around a few different titles, but it just seemed so obvious that that's what was happening, that we were we were actually going back to something that I knew on a cellular level from my childhood. Not that I grew up, as I say in the book, knowing how to garden or do any of those things, but it was all around me, albeit pretend on the set. But they were real cows and they were real chickens and they laid real eggs. And I knew that I wanted to have that around me at some point. I just didn't know how to go about it.
You write in the book that the realtor who showed you the property stood silently while you inspected the property, like a gallery owner who can't believe two people like the worst painting on display. I love that line. Tell me a little about that moment, your first impressions of the property. You found it on Zillow and you're standing in this house in which all the possessions were still there. The owner hadn't got rid of anything. I think even down to cereal in the cupboards.
Yes, exactly. When we pulled up, the outside of the house and the grounds of the 14 acres were absolutely stunningly beautiful. Even in the dead of winter, without a lot of snow on the ground when things are kind of dead, and it still was lush and surrounded by evergreens, and you could feel the clean air. And the cottage itself, or the cabbage as it came to be known, it was sort of a mishmash of styles. It had the stucco exterior with some strange sort of wood beams across it that made it feel kind of like English Tudor, but not. It was like an attempt. But it was definitely charming. And then we walked inside and I just took a look at all of the junk, the crap, just everywhere. I've never walked into a house that was for sale that was A, that crowded, and B, no one had lived in for years. So all of the stuff was just left. There was clothes, there was soap in the shower, and the house has a tendency to trap moisture. So everything was kind of wet and it smelled not great. And I walked in and thought, oh, no, 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 no. And then I looked up at this beautiful ceiling. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, that's kind of great. And then I started to kind of look past the crap, which is actually what the chapter is titled, I think. So I started looking past all the stuff at what could be in there. And I started thinking, oh, this could be really fun. Let's do this. And I looked over at Tim just to check and see how he was feeling. And he had this huge grin on his face, like he just, I don't know, discovered uranium or something fantastic. Or I don't know. He looked like he was home. And that's when I knew we were going to be okay. But it was going to take a ton of work. And it did.
Yeah, as you say in the book, it wasn't exactly staged.
Oh, Lord. No, it was anti-state. It was the opposite. Like, if you want to repel people from the house, this is what you do. Short of having, you know, a bunch of litter boxes and cats everywhere that really make it smelly, that was like the one step that was missing.
This was a very novel experience for you, excuse the pun. You were here in Barryville in Sullivan County, just down the road from the bookstore where we're recording this episode. It's a sea change for you and your sort of former life. And if you'll allow me to quote from your husband's introduction to the book, I think he really captures some of the essence of that. He writes, "When Melissa and I met, I was directing a television pilot in Los Angeles, but lived full-time on a lake in Michigan. Melissa lived in a house in Studio City. She drove a convertible. Her hair was fiery red, and her movie star sunglasses were perfect. There was absolutely no anonymity to her life. When we were out, I'd hear the brakes on passing cars screech as people rubbernecked to see the beautiful icon I was sitting next to. She'd recently come off Dancing with the Stars and was fit, a perfect 10. And yet she was utterly confused about how to stay on the gerbil wheel of Hollywood. She frequented her Botox specialist as if the doctor's office were a Starbucks drive-thru. She was injected, augmented, and veneered, and doing everything right for an actress closing in on 50, trying to maintain a career as an ingenue." I thought that was so good. I mean, you're sitting here now. I've got to tell the listeners, you're wearing overalls, you know, sensible boots, thick country socks. Your hair is up. You know, this is not the Melissa Gilbert that Timothy Busfield spied in Hollywood that day.
No, this is the different one. This is probably the Melissa Gilbert that was inside the veneer of the shiny redhead in the convertible. I definitely was stuck and living in a place where I felt stifled and unable just to age and be myself. And everything around me perpetuated that. I found that in LA, it's too easy to fall into that there. And the pressure to stay young and stay thin and stay relevant, it was too much, and it's not who I wanted to be. So I sort of feel like that was the shell of me. And then this person burst out of there, first with our moving to Michigan, and then ultimately moving to the city and going back on stage and doing theater again definitely rooted me artistically. And then we found our home up here, and it all kind of came together perfectly. And then we all locked down. And by the time we locked down, I was already fully me and ready to just sit around in sweats and pajamas all day anyway. And this gave me license to do that.
What I was so struck by in this book is you really rejected the term midlife crisis for the way in which you dramatically shifted gear. But you talk about a midlife reassessment of priorities, just realizing that there's a real satisfaction to be gained from a kind of simplification of life.
Yep. No, there's no question. And I think the process of the midlife reassessment actually started years before. It really started with going on tour with the Little House on the Prairie musical and then ultimately breaking my back and recovering from that surgery, which dovetailed into my divorce from my second husband. That was really a reassessment for me, because recovering from the broken back and having gone through that, I decided that I was no longer going to push myself to do things that made me uncomfortable, that I was going to be happy and peaceful and comfortable no matter what that took. And so that was sort of the beginning of that genesis. And then after that, a few things got in the way, and then meeting Tim and then moving to Michigan. And then ultimately it all led to here. And I'm at this really joyous, peaceful, calm place in my life. And it's really interesting to have found that in a time of such tumult in the world. Not that I don't get nuts about stuff still. But I wouldn't sacrifice my own well-being and my own peaceful place in my life for anything at this point.
In the book, your anecdote about breaking your back, it reads like a scene from Waiting for Guffman. You're in this touring musical and they use this snow, but kind of made of soap. So everyone's slipping up on the stage. Everybody gets an injury and you get an injury, but carry on. And it's only later when you go to a doctor and he turns around and says, you broke your back. I just thought at that point, the things that actors have to go through.
And for me too, to top it off as a child actor, you know, we weren't allowed to get sick or hurt. I mean, I worked as a kid with a broken wrist. I worked with a dislocated knee. I had to go to work. So I got very, very good at sacrificing my own well-being for the job, because the show must go on. And we really have that pounded into us. And emotionally too. I'm really sad today, but I can't. I got to go to work. Whatever it was my former therapist of 30 years used to call it the porcelain doll. There she goes. She's perfect. She looks great. There's no chips, but inside it's just all crushed.
You told the story beautifully in your first memoir of being a child who was adopted on birth by the Gilberts, and then a child star at the age of 9. There are all sorts of narratives about child stars. Many of them don't end happily. How did being both adopted,
yes,
and then a child actor affect your psyche?
It was something I always knew. I have no memory of there being a moment where, you know, my parents sat me down and said, now listen, we have to tell you. Primarily because of a book, actually. My mother got a book called Special Chosen, which was a story, it was written in the 50s or 60s, about a mother and a father who adopted a little boy and then a little girl. And she crossed out all their names and wrote in all of our names and turned the boy into a girl and the girl into a boy, my brother. Wow. And that's one of the first books I learned to read. So not only did I think I was special chosen, not adopted, but special chosen, I thought they wrote a book about me. So I was kind of proud of that.
Yeah.
But deep down inside, I think for a very, very, very significant part of my life, particularly after my father died and after my parents divorced, which is when my sort of fear of abandonment issues really became solidified and drove so much in my life. There was a part of me deep down inside that thought, if I'm bad, they might give me back.
Right.
Not that they ever would, or that it would even occur to my family to do anything remotely like that. But in my head, unless you know the story of your birth itself, which I didn't, my mother made up a wonderful fairy tale about it. There was always a part of me that thought someone didn't want me right away, until I grew up enough to realize, oh, wait a minute, that's the opposite. Especially when I found out the story of my birth mother and father, but my birth mother most especially, had three children of her own before. And he had three children, and they ran off together and got pregnant with number seven with six kids in the house. So it wasn't that they didn't love me enough to keep me. It's they loved me so much they knew they couldn't give me the life that they wanted me to have. And that, to me, is such an extraordinary loving sacrifice that makes me feel better and more special again.
Do you spend any time wondering or thinking about the life you would have lived had you not been adopted?
I did, certainly when I went to meet my birth father's family in Vegas and sort of, you know, and I still have a slight connection with my birth sister, half-sister from that side of the family. So I did see where their lives went. And, you know, I probably would have ended up living in Vegas too, and God knows doing what to and with myself. I don't know. It's been rough for them. Everybody's life has rough moments, but it would have been considerably different. They are all artists and musicians, which probably would have been nurtured in me, but I couldn't have done it as a profession, I don't think. I'd probably end up a topless blackjack dealer or something.
Instead, you end up in one of the, you know, best loved, most successful TV shows in history. So just before we started recording, I mentioned that I'd watched an episode of Little House on the Prairie titled Sweet 16, in which your character gets her first job as a teacher and then ends up at the church social with her sweetheart. But in real life, that was quite a challenging episode to
very play. Challenging. I was 16, but a not socially adept 16-year-old at all, very sheltered, very protected. And the gentleman playing my love interest, Dean Butler, is the actor's name, was in his 20s. And he was a big grown-up man with the car and a girlfriend. And we had to kiss. And first of all, I was just uncomfortable to begin with because I had very little experience with boys, full stop. But also having my mother stand next to the camera, off camera, sobbing out loud, just added to the whole lack of comfort on my part. And the whole relationship between us, between Dean Butler, who played Almanzo Wilder on Little House, it was always uncomfortable from then on because I was so intimidated by the physicality of the relationship, having had no experience with boys at all. I put a wall up. I mean, I was there. I did what they asked me to do because, as I've said, the show must go on. But I did it feeling very, very uncomfortable and scared sometimes.
Why do you think your mother chose to attend the set that day?
She really didn't come much at all. I had set sitters, and I think she came because it was a big moment in the life of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Laura Ingalls at that point, because this was the man she was eventually going to marry. It was my first kiss on screen, and I think she wanted to be a part of it. It was a big deal, and so she came, and I wasn't asked, and so there was my mom watching me get kissed on screen, which was just not okay.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin. My guest today is the actor Melissa Gilbert. Was there a moment when you had moved here and were having to figure out life up here when you became conscious or were aware that this is it, this is working, this is what I've looked for in my life?
I think it really hit me on the days where Tim and I were working and building the chicken coop and the chicken run and the bear fence and the vegetable garden and being outside and building this stuff ourselves. As tired and filthy and sticky as I was, I couldn't have been happier because I was doing something that was going to benefit our lives in such a tremendous way. We were going to be able to, if we needed to be, we could live off the grid. but we were contributing to our environment, our community. We were taking the strain off of the food supply chain. And at the same time, I was so fulfilled and so exhausted. And I felt like I wanted to feel that way for the rest of my days, that I had accomplished something. I'm still learning new things and trying new things. And I'm learning new crafts. I just started doing cross-stitch embroidery. So I'm making a sampler now. So, you know, it continues to evolve. And the more that I do, the more of a sense of accomplishment I get, the more excited I am to try something new.
Well, talking about activities that you learn to master, there's a great moment towards the end of the memoir where you write a list of all the things you know how to do. I wonder if you'd mind reading it for us.
Sure. One day when it was raining and I was in a bit of a reflective mood, thank you very much, pandemic, I made a list of things I know how to do. And as silly as that might sound, it made me feel good, like I've done something with my life, like I haven't been afraid to try. It also made me eager to add to the list. Things I know how to do. Tell a joke. Juggle. During my senior year of high school, our teacher, Coach Burr, gave us extra credit if we learned to juggle. Ever the overachiever, I asked my pal and prom date, Michael Landon Jr., who knew how to juggle, to teach me, and he did. Make amazing fried chicken. Paint the crap out of a paint-by-numbers kit. Play the Beatles' entire Golden Slumbers Carry That Weight, the end medley, on drums, including Ringo's solo. Get married. I learned from some real pros. And for me, the third time is the charm. Surf. Throw a perfect spiral. Tour the country in a musical for 9 months with a broken back. Hit multiple bullseyes with my crossbow. Run for Congress. One of these days, I may win. Negotiate a $200 million collective bargaining agreement. Do a one-woman show in a theater in the West Village. It was called My Brilliant Divorce by Geraldine Aron, directed by my friend Aideen Maloney for her Fallen Angel Theater Company, and it was the most challenging experience I've ever had as an actor. Throw a frisbee like a champ. Use a table saw and a circular saw. Build a chicken coop. Put up an electric fence. Scare off a bear. Assemble any toy, piece of furniture, stereo, when those existed, anything. I read the instructions and love putting things together. Handle an emergency. This is a skill I've had my whole life, whether it was when my sister had a gnarly gash in her finger, my brother had thorns embedded in his leg, or my kids broke bones or needed stitches. For some reason, I'm very calm under pressure. Once it's all over, though, I fall apart. Go back to school and get a degree in nursing, a dream I intend to fulfill in this lifetime. Find a place of real love and understanding in my heart for those with whom my past has been prickly. That's a big one. Hang out with my ex-husbands without it being the least bit weird.
Wonderful. I think we should all create lists like that just to remind us that...
Yeah, that we can do things.
We can do things. Life is full of possibility. Melissa, you mentioned in that list there, running for Congress. This was when you were living in Michigan with your husband, Timothy Busfield. You had to pull out because of injury. Would you consider running for Congress again?
I have to say that it depends on the political climate. When I ran in 2016, things were starting to get rough politically. Just the overall volume was really starting to crank up because that was the beginning of the emergence of Donald Trump as candidate. And so it was starting to get loud. I think if I'd had to be there in that climate with that particular leadership, it would have been very difficult for me to maintain anything that feels like peaceful and comfort and calm. There's nothing that riles me up faster than intolerance and anger and bad politics. And so I don't see myself running for office, although I did run for office up here. I feel better as boots on the ground, really.
You're listening to Shelf Life with my guest, the actor Melissa Gilbert. We're talking about her new memoir, Back to the Prairie, and two of her favorite books, L.A. Requiem by Robert Crace and Fall on Your Knees by Anne-Marie MacDonald. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we'll hear from an economic historian who just won a Nobel Prize.
Look, the good old days may have been old, but they weren't good. They were terrible.
Joel Mokyr on progress and how we might be preventing it.
It's one of the great unforced errors in history.
How does progress really happen? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Shelf Life with my guest, the actor Melissa Gilbert. We're talking about L.A. Requiem by Robert Crace. Melissa, of all the things you did in the pandemic, the learning the ukulele, the Italian, the paint by numbers, the mosaicing, the knitting, the planting a bountiful garden, the rearing of chickens, I take it you also found some time to do some reading, which is a clumsy and not so subtle way of introducing the first of two books you've chosen to talk about today, which is L.A. Requiem, the eighth book in the Elvis Cole and Joe Pike series, named for the two detectives who drive the narrative. The author is Robert Crace. In many ways, it's a classic mystery format. A woman has gone missing, turns up dead, and two private eyes are asked to investigate, since the cops have a reputation for bungling investigations. But there's lots of brilliant and unpredictable twists in this book. I have to say, it was a rip-roaring read. I love a good detective or mystery novel, and this satisfied my deepest cravings. I take it, Melissa, that you're a fan of mystery and detective novels. What is it about this one or the work of Robert Crace that elevates it above others?
I'm sure there are bigger Robert Crace fans out there, but from the moment I picked up my first book of his, which I don't think was L.A. Requiem, but I've read them all, and I have to say I do, like you, love a good mystery. I love trying to figure out who did it. There's something very stimulating for me in my brain, but I also love these two men. I love the way Bob has written them. And I can call him Bob because he's a friend of mine, because I wrote him a fan letter and he got it and we became friends. So anytime we have a new book coming, we send each other galleys of our books, and he's just so talented. And the way he's able to weave the stories of these people's lives in with the lives around them and the whodunit, it's got heart. His books have heart, they're sexy, they're interesting. And his descriptions of LA and then New Orleans, which is another one of my favorite cities in the world, they're so rich. And his aide memoir, his ability to describe what the characters are feeling and seeing and tasting and smelling, it's so compelling. I feel like I'm in LA. He describes landmarks I grew up looking at so clearly. And New Orleans, same thing, which I know relatively well. And he weaves all of this together in this incredible way, and you get to go on this adventure. And it gets, Aaron, it gets even better in the upcoming books when he introduces Maggie the dog. And he writes from Maggie's point of view, this gorgeous, gorgeous German Shepherd with PTSD from serving, I believe it is in Afghanistan, as a bomb-sniffing dog, and now works with the LAPD with someone who has also got PTSD. She's such a hero. He's just my favorite, because it's not just, you know, that sort of gumshoey, not that there's not benefit to that, that kind of Humphrey Bogart with the hat and the black and white movie with the slatted window shades, kind of making it a moody sort of 40s murder mystery. There's something really contemporary and compelling about all of these characters. I don't know which one I'm more in love with, Elvis Cole or Joe Pike, but I'm just mad for both of these men.
It's a great tour guide of LA's streets and neighborhoods, its valleys, parks, suburban landscape. You lived for some time in LA, so you'd know better than I. Does he capture LA for you?
He absolutely captures LA 100%. Yes, he absolutely gets it. That's where he lives, but he has this extraordinary ability to just describe it so clearly that for me, I see exactly what he's writing about, you know? He's an interesting fellow because he started out as a screenwriter in television, and people for decades have been saying they've been trying to buy Joe Pike and Elvis Cole books. And he sold one of his books, Hostage, became a movie with Bruce Willis, God bless him. And it didn't do well, and it was taken out of his hands creatively, and it frustrated him so horribly he will never sell the wow. Joe Pike or Elvis Cole books to be made into films, which I understand, but it makes me sad. Although I can't imagine who you would cast as either of those men, because Brad Pitt's already too old. He could definitely do it, but I think, I don't know.
You've appeared in crime dramas yourself, like Secrets and Lies. Have you ever had to kill someone on screen?
I have not killed someone. I've been killed.
You have?
Oh, yeah. I've been killed a few different ways. I've been exploded in a nuclear spaceship. I have been murdered by a Salvadoran National Guard and buried in a shallow grave in El Salvador. I've been given a heart attack by my cheating husband in a remake of Diabolique. Who else has killed me? That husband's killed me twice. That was my second husband, Bruce Boxleitner, killed me once in that movie and killed me again with the nuclear warship spaceship thing in his television series. No wonder our marriage ended. He killed me twice. He nuked me. It's rude and it burns.
So lots of death in your on-screen life, but no murder.
No, and please, I never get to play the bad guy. Ever, 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 ever. I would give anything. Maybe someday. That's sort of a goal of mine, is to finally play an anti-hero. Play a villain. It would be so much fun. And, you know, this is what we always say, it's casting you'll never see. And Melissa Gilbert as the serial killer. It just doesn't work.
Crace is very good at brevity. He doesn't need a lot of words to convey an atmosphere or an action. In a flashback scene of Joe Pike with his one-time police partner, Wozniak, Crace describes the tension as thick as clotted blood. A car is snapped into gear. Three men look like Cadillac salesmen after a bad month. Reporters cluster around cops outside a crime scene like piranha on bad meat. I loved these pithy, zippy descriptions.
So great.
He doesn't embellish more than he has to. It's economical.
Yep.
But
so effective.
So effective.
Piranhas on bad meat. You can see the cops there. I love his descriptions. I just love it.
Let's play a little section from L.A. Requiem by Robert Crace.
The Santa Anas continued to pick up as we drove north to the second jungle juice. Palm trees, tall and vulnerable like the necks of giant dinosaurs, took the worst of it. The wind stripped the dead fronds that bunched beneath the crowns and tossed them into streets and yards and onto cars. It was a few minutes before noon when we reached the second jungle juice, just south of Universal Studios. It was set in a narrow strip mall that ran along Barham at the base of the mountains and was crowded with Sunday shoppers and tourists trying to find the Universal City Walk, even with the wind. Pike and I stood in line until we reached the counter and showed them the picture of Karen. The girl behind the register, all of 18 with a clean, bright smile and chocolate tan, recognized Karen at once. "Oh, sure, she comes in all the time. She always gets a smoothie after her run." Pike said, "Was she in yesterday?" The girl didn't know and called over a tall African-American kid named Ronnie. Ronnie was a good-looking kid a couple of inches over 6 feet, whose claim to fame was 6 seconds in a Charmin commercial. "Oh, yeah, she comes in here after a run. That's Karen." "Did she come in yesterday?" Now Ronnie squinted at me. "Is she okay?" "I just want to know if she came in yesterday." The squint turned into a frown, went to Pike, then grew suspicious. "What is this?" I showed him the license. He squinted at that too. "Your name really Elvis?" Pike stepped past me until his hips pressed against the counter. Ronnie was maybe an inch taller than Joe, but Ronnie took a fast step back. Joe said, "Did she come in here or not?" Voice so soft you could barely hear him. Ronnie shook his head, eyes bugging. "Not yesterday. I work from opening to 6 and she didn't come in. I would have known because we always talk about a run. I jog too." You know where she runs? Sure, she parks down here and runs up the hill there to the reservoir. He gestured across Barham to the hill. Lake Hollywood Drive meandered up through a residential area to the reservoir. The girl said, I'm pretty sure I saw her drive past yesterday. Well, it was a little red car. I didn't see her or anything, just the car. Ronnie said, No way. Karen always comes in after the run, and she didn't come in. Like he was disappointed that maybe she had come for the run and not stopped in to see him. No way. We thanked them, then went out to the parking lot. I said, Well, that's something. She shows up for her run, but she doesn't go in for the smoothie, which is her habit. Pike walked to the street, then looked back at the parking lot. It was small and empty of red Mazdas. He said, She runs, but maybe she remembers something and doesn't have time to get the smoothie. Or she meets someone, and they decide to do something else. Yeah, like go to his place for a different kind of smoothie. Pike looked at me. Sorry. He stared up the hill. You're probably right. If she runs to the reservoir, she probably follows Lake Hollywood up. Let's drive it.
Hello, this is Shelf Life, and my guest today is the actor Melissa Gilbert. We're talking about two of her favorite novels. Melissa, we were talking earlier about Elvis Cole and Joe Pike as these sort of great male characters. They really are classics of the genre. Joe Pike is mostly silent and is described as wearing a gray sweatshirt with the sleeves cut off, faded Levi's, and flat black pilot's glasses, which is the way he dresses every day of his life. Mm. He and Elvis Cole have killed many men between them, and yet there's real compassion, I found, to both of them. There's a moving flashback in which we get the story of the young Joe Pike, beaten by his alcoholic father and determined to be able to hold his ground against anything and anyone. You know, we're told that he reads a lot, which made me happy, including Nietzsche. Have you met men like this in your life?
Oh, merciful heavens. I think I have. I actually think I'm married to one. I'm married to a non-reader, which is interesting. But we've been together long enough that I read aloud. And that's how we read together, which is something I'd never done with a partner ever. There's something very Renaissance man about Tim as well. He's an incredible protector, which is what I think of when I think of Joe Pike and Elvis Cole. I see these great protectors, but with tremendous gentleness. And I think Tim has that for sure. I'm watching him with this puppy we just rescued, and he couldn't be more gentle and yet more protective. And he did have a difficult childhood as well. So, yeah, in a way, I think it's Tim.
Can we talk about your father? I know that shortly after completing your memoir, you discovered a family secret or a secret that had been kept from you.
My father passed away when I was 11. And the year before he passed, he had a stroke. And so a year later, my mother came into my room, brought my brother in that morning and told us that our father had passed away in his sleep from a second stroke. And that was all I knew for a very long time. That was traumatic enough and really shaped who I was from that moment forward. There's Melissa before my father died, and there's Melissa after my father died. And then there's Melissa, who at 45 found out the truth of how my father died. My sister called me on the phone, and she had read my book, and my mother had read my book and hated my book, and my sister was worried about the book, and she and I were talking on the phone, and I said, I don't understand, what's the problem? And she said, I'm afraid this book is going to cause a rift in the family. And I said, Sarah, there's so many unanswered questions in my life. Like, I mean, my father died. I didn't get to go to the funeral. Where are his things? How come I don't talk about him? How can we talk about everybody else? And she started crying. And she said, I have to tell you something. Now, this is my baby sister, half-sister technically, although we don't really count that stuff. And her father, 5 years before, had passed away from cancer. And she told me that on his deathbed, he confessed to her that he knew something about my father and the way he died. And so she was kind of trying to soften the blow until finally I said, I don't understand what you're trying to say. And she said, Melissa, your father killed himself. He shot himself with a gun. It knocked me for a massive loop. The only people who knew were my mother, my sister's father, who had since passed away, my grandmother, who had dementia. They answered the door when the police came from my father's house to notify me and my brother, because we were the next of kin. And they made a vow not to tell anyone. Even my father's best friend didn't know. No one knew. All the people who came to his funeral, hundreds apparently of people, no one knew. It was never discussed, ever, ever, ever. So ultimately, I hired a PI firm, and I had them pull the coroner's report, the death certificate, and the police report without photographs so that I knew what had happened. And it was all right there. He'd had a stroke the year before. He was under the care of the VA. He was in chronic excruciating pain. He kept telling people he wanted to die. He kept saying he was going to jump off of a building. He kept asking people for help. And finally, the morning that he did die, he woke up that morning. He was living with a woman, had been for 7 years, Natalie. He told her to go in the other room and call an ambulance because he was in so much pain he wanted to go to the hospital. And while she was on the phone, he pulled out the handgun that he'd gotten and shot himself. When the coroner did his autopsy, there was nothing in my father's bloodstream but Tylenol. You know, he was an acrobat in the circus as a child. This is not someone who did well with having to pull themselves up on a triangle over the bed, crippled, and nobody did anything to help him. And so I now carry that with me too. And it's part of the fabric of who I am. And it's his story. And I felt like I needed to tell people about it because I need to honor that decision that he made.
So you see some of your husband in Elvis Cole and Joe Pike. I wonder if you've also seen some of your father.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Listen, my father was my hero, my first hero ever. So anybody that I see is heroic, especially even remotely theatrical, which I think Joe and Elvis both are, even though they try really hard not to be. I mean, just the description of the cutoff shirt and the aviator glasses and the jeans. It's like, come on, dude, you really don't want anyone looking at you yet? What are you doing? And my father was hyper masculine. I mean, he wore tuxedos to work as a stand-up comic and a singer and a dancer. And he wore jumpsuits in his workshop when he built furniture, and he smoked, and he was married 13 times. It's ridiculous.
It's incredible.
It's just ridiculous. Apparently, as a stand-up comic, the joke was, he would say, because it was sort of legendary that he was married that many times, that he didn't believe in premarital sex. Ba-dum-bum. My mother still to this day says that's not true. And yet it's clearly, if you do the investigation, it's so true. The oft-married Paul Gilbert, every press clipping about him, he was married 13 times.
How does anyone have time to get married 13 times?
I don't know, but God bless you, Paulie Gilbert. Whatever it was, he was, you know, he was that guy. Wow. I remember him so clearly backstage at his gigs. He would walk around in his tuxedo, shirt, and jacket, tie undone, but not put his pants on. He'd have his boxers on, not put his pants on until just before he went on stage, so they were never wrinkled.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's it. That's old school class there, making sure your pants are perfectly...
Before you walk out on stage and do a front right flip way and land on the stage, let's make sure you have no wrinkles. Walking around with his lucky strikes.
You're listening to Shelf Life with my guest, the actor Melissa Gilbert. We're talking about her new memoir, Back to the Prairie, and two of her favorite books. Melissa, let's move on to your second book choice, Fall on Your Knees by the Canadian writer Anne-Marie MacDonald. This is a book that many listeners may be familiar with. I took a look on Goodreads earlier today, and it has 63,000 plus ratings on that site. It was a 2002 Oprah Winfrey pick. It's been translated into 19 languages. So it's a established classic for a lot of people. It chronicles four generations of the Piper family who get into all sorts of trouble, starting with James, the son of Gaelic-speaking parents. He elopes with a young girl, a 13-year-old daughter of prominent Lebanese immigrants. It's a story that shifts back and forward in time. It deals with racial tension, isolation, domestic abuse, forbidden love, among many other things. It's a big book, packed with ideas. What about it spoke to you?
This book, actually, as you're describing it, I'm now thinking I have to reread this because it had such an impact on me when I read it the first time in 2002. The tapestry of this family, you know, I remember so clearly starting out reading this book and thinking, oh, this is going to make an incredible film. And then reading a bit more and going, oh, well, these will make a couple incredible films. Oh, no, this is about a 10 movie arc. You can't make this. This is not even a television series. I don't know how she wrote this. Just the logistics of sitting down to beat out a story that is this complex and multi-generational and goes in so many different directions, but it must have been such a chore. I sort of see like this corkboard in my head with lots of sticky, you know, thumbtacks of notes. But for me, it was the sweeping saga of this family, but also interesting at that time, the thing that undermines everyone is secrets. And at that time in my life, when I look back to 2001, 2002, I was still living so comfortably in the secrets of all that I was, in the secrets of my life, and had been hiding so much away for so long. Now I look back at this book and go, well, of course that's why it hooked into me so much, because I was reading about essentially myself. And, you know, I've always said that every time a new family secret comes out, I feel like the rug gets pulled out from under me again because I didn't know the truth. And so in reading that book, I saw the damage that the secrets did in that family and could absolutely relate to the sort of sense of secrecy I had in my own life. And then there's just the romance of the sweeping multi-generational family saga of where people come from and who they become and why they become and how they meet the love of their life, or the person that is almost the love of their life, and where those children come from and where they go. And it's just a tremendous accomplishment, the book in and of itself. And I've got to read it again. I'm going to get another copy and read it again, because it'll be interesting to see it from these eyes now.
You mentioned there that you could identify as someone who's experienced an awful lot of secrecy in growing up and in your own life. There's a lot of dysfunction in Fall on Your Knees. You've been admirable in telling us what was going on behind the kind of happy pastoral scenes of Little House on the Prairie, you know, how you'd be told how to eat, how to dress, how to go about your career. But not all fans of Little House on the Prairie wanted to know the true stories, did they? You said earlier that your mother was unhappy with the book.
The first book, yes.
Why was that?
Well, now that I know what I know, she was trying to keep this massive secret a secret as long as possible still. And I think she was afraid that I would embarrass her with her friends, which I did. We had a very hard time between finding out about my father and my book coming out. It was a very prickly time for the two of us. It's taken us a lot of years to really find this wonderful, peaceful place that we're at together now. I don't blame her for being worried about the first book, but it was my story, and I had to, at that time, I had to get it out. I'm not fond of that book. It's interesting. I dismiss it often because I feel like so much of what I wrote about was based on the loss of my father, which I didn't know the truth of. Although it was the truth of my life at that time, now I look at it and go, well, that's not true. That book is a lie, because it was not based in what actually happened. And it may have been, I think this first book, I was really hyper open and honest about a great deal of my life that I would probably keep a little more locked away this go round. But again, you know, I was coming from this place of being in the public eye, being the shiny redheaded in the convertible car. My life is an open book. I'll tell you anything. Ha, ha, ha. There's no discretion. My life is yours. Here's the story about me having sex with Rob Lowe on the couch outside my mother's bedroom. Now I've sort of look at that and go, no, there's no reason. There's really, it doesn't serve anything or anyone. Why am I telling this story?
There's an interesting distinction in the two books you've chosen, because L.A. Requiem is a book about men. It's very masculine. Fall on Your Knees centers women's experiences. There's a lot in the book that touches on a young woman's coming of age, trying to find her identity, particularly with the character of Frances, who fantasizes about the world of spectacle and performance. She emulates the actress Louise Brooks, attempting to straighten her hair. I wondered how you navigated self-expression, particularly at such a tumultuous time as adolescence, when you're on the screen. Did you have idols that you tried to emulate?
Oh, yeah. I had so many. The cultural icons of the 70s, like Susan Day on The Partridge Family, any of the Brady girls, Jane Fonda, Diana Ross, I thought was incredible. But ultimately, I mean, these were people that I felt were whose lives I felt were unattainable, that there was no way I would ever be like that. Instead, as an adolescent, honestly, like one of my biggest pastimes was laying on the floor in my bedroom with my record player and headphones, listening to Janis Ian's At 17 on repeat and just crying. That was my adolescence. I was sure that no one was going to ask me to a dance, that I was going to be playing solitaire my whole life, that I would never have a boyfriend or a partner of any kind, and that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear-skinned smiles who married young, and I was just going to be the second banana the rest of my life. Meantime, I'm also the most recognizable young person on the planet, but it has no bearing on my life at all.
You mentioned listening to Janis Ian on your record player. One of the movies that Frances attends in this book is called Diary of a Lost Girl. And it ends with a title card: if there were more love in this world, no one would ever have to be lost. And I saw an echo of that in the last lines of your new memoir, in which you close with the refrain, love, 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 from the Beatles song, All You Need Is Love. The Beatles seems to have been a singular influence for you.
Massive. Massive. I mean, massive. My first, earliest, clearest memory in childhood was being in the bathtub and singing Yellow Submarine. And I think I was 2. So this is 68. And the Beatles, in all their incarnations, their music has always been there in my life.
Well, it would be very tempting to leave listeners with that image of 2-year-old Melissa Gilbert in the bathtub singing Yellow Submarine. But I have to actually close, I think, with asking what you've been reading aloud to your husband, Timothy Busfield, lately.
I am currently obsessed with Mary Roach's books. Her books are nonfiction. They're stiff. There's Grunt is the one about war. There's Gulp, which is about the Alimentary Canal. So Stiff is her research into what happens to a human cadaver. When you will your body to science, where does it go? And what do we do with it? And she does her research. And apparently, it's coming up in Bonk. She does the research with her husband. They go to one of these clinics and actually make love, like in an MRI or something. I think she actually talked him into this. It's really fascinating stuff, especially for someone with a medicine brain. I wanted to be a doctor for a very, very long time and still have this dream of at least getting my nursing degree. I don't know. There's not a ton of time, but someday. So these books are great. And she's written them with great humor. And I think they're quite fun and I'm really enjoying it.
There you go. If there are not enough bodies for you in L.A. Requiem, then you can turn to Stiff by Mary Roach. Melissa Gilbert, thank you so much for being my guest. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks, Aaron. This was lovely. Thank you.
We've been talking about L.A. Requiem by Robert Crace, published by Ballantine Books, and Fall on Your Knees by Anne-Marie MacDonald, published by Scribner. Melissa Gilbert's new memoir, Back to the Prairie, is published by Gallery Books. You can find them all at any good bookstore, and you can find more episodes of Shelf Life on most podcast platforms. This podcast is produced by Grand Journal in association with WJFF Radio Catskill. My thanks as always to our producer, Ilya Maritz, to our sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com. and from listeners like you.
Hi, I'm co-star Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me, the Music Emporium. Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.